The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester United just minutes away from defying the odds and winning a home game. Were they good or were Liverpool bad? And how hard do you have to kick Divock Origi before the VAR man intervenes? Elsewhere, David Silva scores a cracker, the Spurs crisis continues, Leicester keep up their good start and Chelsea win again. Maybe Frank Lampard is tactically astute after all. Meanwhile, Everton get a much needed win in the meh derby and Sean Dyche is angry about technology. But is he right? We'll discuss the latest depressing racist incidents, including Haringey Borough's manager taking his side off the pitch in the FA Cup against Yeovil. In the Football League, West Brom lead the way. In Spain, Real lose. In Italy, Nangolan scores an absolute belter, while it's tight in Germany. But you don't know tight until you've seen the top of the league in Sweden. We'll do all that, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson. Hello.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Hey, Mark Langdon.
Hello, Max.
It's very nice to see you.
And you.
We were at a charity dinner on Thursday.
We were raising money for a good cause.
Mm. I noticed at the end of your main course, your plate was covered in peas.
Yeah, I mean, there was no point in them being there, were they, really? It was a really nice sort of bit of meat and there was some nice potatoes.
I wonder if, because you were out in public, you really felt the need to really keep them out there on the plate, and had it been at home, you may have snuck one in.
No, I mean, yeah, it's not true that I'm a vegan sort of indoors and then just a complete carnivore outside. I mean, I just genuinely don't like vegetables.
Hey, Barry.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
And you?
You well?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Excellent. Right, let's start at Old Trafford then. Manchester United 1, Liverpool 1. A few weeks ago, we tried to predict when Liverpool would first drop points. Nobody called this game. Liverpool seemed very flat. Did they get it wrong, Jonathan, or did Solskjaer get it right?
Well, I think Solskjaer definitely got it right. And I think Liverpool seemed also to have, you know, this psychological issue of playing at Old Trafford, that going into the game, I think they only won one of the previous 13 there. But Solskjaer playing the back three, pushing Wan-Bissaka and Young high up, definitely interrupted the way that Liverpool's fullbacks play. So they were crossing from much deeper. And although Andy Robertson ends up getting the assist for the equaliser, if you look at their cross success percentage in the league games up until that game, it had been, I think, 27.6%. In this game, it was 17.6%. So you've got to give Solskjaer credit for that. And also at the other end, it worked playing Pereira as sort of a false nine with Rashford and James, the sort of split strikers. I guess the fact both of them often play wide means they're more used to that. But that also then means that they're better equipped to exploit that space behind the fullbacks, which means they're going to be more cautious about going forward. And Pereira playing there suddenly puts loads of defensive responsibility on Fabinho, which in the first half he struggled with.
Jurgen Klopp said, when we came here this year, last year and the year before, they just defended. It's not a criticism, it's a fact. Sounds, Mark, a little bit like a criticism to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is always going to be probably a more difficult game maybe for Liverpool there, a bit like when they go to Goodison Park than some other teams, if they're playing against Manchester United. If you think back to that Arsenal game a few weeks ago, I think if Manchester United would have played like that against Liverpool, then even an off-form Liverpool would have beaten them, because they were disorganised at times. There was a lot of space in the defence when Aubameyang scored the goal, and there were other opportunities too. I was a bit conflicted, though, by Manchester United's performance, because they were good defensively and they counter-attacked quite well. It did feel, and I think this is maybe what Klopp's alluded, it felt a bit like a small team mentality that accepted their place within the kind of Premier League rankings.
Well, that's definitely true, and it was the second lowest possession percentage United recorded at home since Opta started recording stats in 2003. So that is absolutely true. But once you've accepted that they are no longer at Liverpool's level, yeah, I think tactically
you've got
it right.
So then you have to give Solskjaer the credit, right? You have to say he's looked at it and said, they're better than us. We have to set up accordingly.
I think that's true. Although the message he actually sends out in his programme notes and also in the press is very much about how Manchester United are still Manchester United, and he talks about them very much in being a big sort of team mentality about them still. But if you have a look at their last nine matches, it's only been 13 goals in them. So, I mean, they are a team, I think, that's struggling in the final third. But if you are doing that, then I suppose, you know, get yourself right defensively. And on expected goals, they're the best team defensively this season. So he is doing that part of the job right. But I also can understand Klopp's, not frustration, but the point he was making.
For one of the first times ever, I felt sorry for Man. You know that feeling when someone scores a goal and you feel sort of a bit sick for the team that's conceded it? I felt sorry for Manchester United. And I don't know if I've ever felt that before. Was that just me? Or did you share that compassion?
No, not particularly. I wasn't sure who I wanted to win. I was having this discussion with a mate. It's like the short-term immediate pleasure you get from seeing Manchester United get beaten, and then versus the big picture of Liverpool winning the league. And you so a draw is probably the fairest for people like me who are petty and mean-spirited. I think it's quite telling that it was the worst I've seen Liverpool play for quite some time, and they still didn't lose. And you wonder who would have been more pleased after the game, and it's difficult to know. You talk about Martin Tyler talking about, you know, playing Manchester United, playing the game, not the occasion. I think Liverpool did the opposite. They played the occasion. They saw Old Trafford, as dilapidated as it might be at the moment. It's still this fortress that they seem quite overawed by. And draw was probably a fair result.
Is this a blueprint of how to play Liverpool then?
I think it may be. I think engaging the fullbacks high up definitely interrupts Liverpool. I think the playing with the back three with the two very deep line midfielders, that sort of trapezium shape that Conte used at Chelsea, I think it's then much harder for Firmino to find space. I think you saw Liverpool's passing was much poorer than it normally is, not just in execution but also in conception. I think that's because the usual passes they play weren't on. So yeah, I don't think there is such a thing as a sort of magic bullet that this will kill Liverpool for forever. But it certainly is a very effective way of disrupting them. The other thing is, if you're basically saying, right, we're going to block up the centre and you're going to have to cross. And this is what Arsenal tried to do at Liverpool, but they did it with a back four and three holding midfielders sat in front. So they basically sacrificed the wings to Alexander-Arnold and Robertson. But they were putting in crosses from much higher up the pitch. And I think they put in, I can't remember, 20-odd crosses in the first half, and eventually one found, who was it, got the opening goal? Matip, was it? Or Van Dijk?
It was Matip.
Matip. Which was a corner, but it was another cross into the box. And that's the danger, you know, that eventually one of those crosses is just going to be the perfect cross, and not much you can do about it. But if you've got three central defenders in there, all of whom are pretty good in the air, then obviously you minimise the chances of conceding a goal like that.
Do you think Liverpool just played badly and Manchester United were quite lucky that they turned up and played badly, or were they forced into playing badly?
I think both. Yeah, I think whatever anxiety they had going there, and I think it's pretty clear they do have a slight issue with that for very understandable reasons, was then magnified by finding United being playing in a shape that maybe they weren't expecting. Although the news they were playing back three did seem to break on the Saturday night. I mean, certainly I was sort of getting messages.
Well, you have tactical updates apps that other people don't.
I was in a pub with other journalists.
Doesn't surprise me. But actually on that, the discussion is that there is perhaps an issue with Liverpool's midfield if they are coming up against a stubborn defence, that they're very, very good at running a lot and being very disruptive, and they leave the attacking to the front three, who obviously were missing Salah yesterday. And so you have to change that three, which Klopp did, I guess. He brought Oxlade-Chamberlain and Lallana on.
Oh, yeah, I think you have to give Klopp credit for that, because what he did by the initial switch to the 4-3-1 at half-time, suddenly you then have your wide players high up. So United's wing-backs have to decide, do we keep pushing high up, or do we sit on Henderson and Mane? And then when that didn't really work, the switch to 4-4-2 magnifies that. So Klopp also comes out of it with credit for having you know, acknowledged what Solskjaer have done and found a way of countering that.
Here's a question from Billy. This week, Sky launched a Brexit-free news channel. Should they also start VAR-free commentary option?
I think that's quite a good idea. We should perhaps have an alternative episode of each Football Weekly as well, in which, you know, one in which we discuss VAR and the other in which we don't. I know which one I'd listen to.
So the first point of VAR will be the first goal. It's actually, Mark, a lovely goal, isn't it? Daniel James, it's a brilliant cross. The centre-forward play from Rashford is superb because he runs, he makes Matip think that he's going to go to the near post and then he just cuts to the far post, and you've got to be lucky that the cross goes there, but he actually did everything right.
Oh, he did, and I think that's been a criticism of Rashford, that his movement inside the box hasn't been good enough when he's played up sort of in that central striking role for Manchester United, and this was you know, maybe a point and a head in the right direction for that. I mean, outside of that, United didn't create many chances. I didn't share Klopp's anger over the fact that it was allowed. I mean, more often than not, it probably is given as a foul, but once play had gone on, I think from what we've seen most of what VAR's this season, it was never getting overturned. It didn't look like a clear and obvious error.
Well, I think that's exactly the point, isn't it? The mistake is by Martin Atkinson, and I think it was a foul, and I think it should have been stopped. But once he's let it go, we've seen VAR doesn't overturn it. So
Mane had a goal disallowed. Moments later, the ball touched his hand as it went down. Carragher said on Sky, Jamie Carragher, that is VAR at its best.
But it also highlights the problem with VAR, right? That
doesn't feel right to me, that. I know I think I'm wrong here. But
I totally accept that as a handball, and I accept that being ruled out. You can argue whether it would have been handball under the old interpretation, but definitely under the new regulation that any handball in the build-up to a goal is a handball, that's a handball. VAR has seen something that will be very, very difficult for referee or linesman to see. So I have no problem with that. The problem is, though, that I don't think when people wanted VAR brought in, what they were bothered about was millimetre calls and offsides and the ball brushing a forward's arm accidentally. They were bothered about people getting kicked in the penalty area and not getting penalties, or
mistaken identity or things like that. Yeah.
Or, you know, a player being kicked, losing possession as a result, and a breakaway leading to a goal. So VAR seems to be doing precisely the opposite to what my understanding is most people wanted.
Yeah, a message from Carl. Basically, one foul means a goal is ruled out. Another foul somehow doesn't mean that. If that kind of inconsistency is codified, then there simply is no point in VAR. They should just do away with it.
Well, over the course of the weekend, there was five goals ruled out. Two handballs, they're correct, fair enough. An offside, fair enough. And two for fouls in the build-up. So that was...
What was your favourite?
What was my favourite?
The Johnny Evans one is the best one, isn't it?
Your favourite.
Oh, favourite. Very good. Well, we'll get on to all of them, won't we? I know you wanted to do your compilation, your new album, Barry. Barry's VAR compilation. You could do it as a kind of... Each week you could do a little video. You could start Instagram TV with just your VAR compilation.
I think I'd lose the will to live very quickly.
we are constantly and pointlessly trying to decide who's the most important out of Mane, Firmino and Salah. You notice the most when they're not there. Salah, massive miss. He was out for the game after that tackle from Hamza Choudhury against Leicester. Could be back in midweek. But that is a thing, right? When your team is missing good... Manchester United obviously were missing good players as well.
Yeah, and I think it all depends what your sort of replacement option is. You know, if you're taking out one... You know, like for like, then it may be not as big an impact. And Origi has done well in terms of scoring important goals for Liverpool. But if you just look at the two sort of credentials of him and Salah, they're not the same. You have to play differently. I don't think that Origi, you know, he wasn't that effective at Old Trafford. I don't think he, you know, is maybe up to the standard required in terms of that football connection that the three of them have got with Firmino and Mane. And I felt that's where a lot of their moves were breaking down. And even in the Champions League final, when he scored the goal, Liverpool had their worst spell when Origi was on the pitch, I felt. And, you know, he's done a really good job in terms of scoring important goals, but he's not, I don't think, of the standard that that can come in and be an able deputy all the time.
He was the only player who started yesterday who also started Klopp's first game, which has been 4 years ago to the weekend.
Good stat.
Manchester United, that same day... So that was a 0-0 draw at Tottenham. The same day, United won 3-0 at Everton, and seven of their match day 18 plus Chris Smalling's on loan are still at United. Only four, or is it three, Liverpool players still remain?
So 8 wins and 1 draw. This is from Mark. I'm a Liverpool fan. Are we actually that good? Very poor against United today. Look quite ropey at the back a lot this season. Did we peak last season? Slightly harsh viewing of what is arguably a reasonable start to the season,
well,
I thought.
What is true, though, is that no side outperforming its XG as much as Liverpool.
Walter says, should Roy Keane be head of recruitment at Manchester United? This refers to Roy on Sky just saying, just go and get Harry Kane. Just go and get him.
Yeah, this is one of those things where a footballer says something in punditry and then all the sort of lad sites clip it and flag it up as this hilarious bit of stand-up comedy performance. United need a striker, a good one, to replace Romelu Lukaku. Harry Kane is an obvious choice, and Roy Keane has said go and get him, and I'm not sure why everyone's making such a big deal about
it. Is it in that room of alpha males, you know, you've got Souness, Neville, Jose, and Roy Keane's going, why are you all staring at me? You know, there's a little bit of a who's the biggest, you know, who's the toughest in town. Bit of a,
who's the biggest? You could fill in a lot of blanks there. Yeah.
Anyway, Liverpool go to Genk on Wednesday.
His point makes sense, though, right?
Yeah.
In the old days, so 15 years ago, United had just gone out and signed the best striker in the Premier League.
And well, they literally did, didn't they? Berbatov.
Berbatov and Carrick from Tottenham. Yeah. And Carrick was very important for them as well.
And that now seems something that... I mean, maybe Harry Kane just would not leave Tottenham. Maybe he wants to stay at that club all his life. But did they try? Has anybody asked the question? I don't know. It's one of those things that kind of... It sort of never occurred to me. Then suddenly Roy Keane says it and you're sort of... Oh, yeah, why was that never an issue?
And Van Persie most pertinently, I guess.
Wasn't it sort of mentioned towards the end of last season and during the summer?
It's not the first time I've heard it, definitely. Yeah. Talking of Harry Kane, let's move on to Spurs-Watford. 1-1. How lucky were Spurs / unlucky were Watford, Barry?
I think Watford were incredibly unfortunate, and Tottenham, who I fancy to lose this game, that was a point won by them. They didn't deserve that point. Watford, I thought, were way better than them on the day. Robbed by a combination of poor officiating and a little bit of bad luck. But if I was a Watford fan, I'd be delighted with that performance. Away from home, bottom of the table, still without a win. But I'd chalk that up as, you know, everything but a win. They were vastly, demonstrably superior to Spurs on the day.
I mean, Decore's goal was a lovely break 6 minutes in, but that wasn't the only time Watford broke through Spurs midfield and defence. They did it a number of times, Mark.
They did. Chose the wrong option a couple of times. Obviously, I think Barry mentioned that the penalty there, you know, in terms of being robbed by the Deulofeu one, that I think most people felt was a penalty. They controlled Tottenham for large parts of this game and should have won. And I think that while Kike Sanchez Flores can take great sort of belief, I think now, you know, because they didn't play particularly well against Sheffield United before the international break. They missed a couple of chances, but they didn't actually play that well in the game. They were much better at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, and Spurs were as bad, I think, maybe not quite as bad as Brighton, but it was still a very, very bad performance from them. The three at the back mentioned how it worked for Manchester United, didn't work at all for Tottenham. Danny Rose carried on his England form. I thought he was at fault for that opening goal, nowhere near strong enough against Jan Mat. Harry Kane, who mentioned as a potential Manchester United striker, his stats are way down on where that they have been into, not just talking about goals, but just sort of the key performance indicators in terms of shots and stuff like that. It's nowhere near where it should be. I don't know if it's an ongoing issue with the ankle or whether it's just a collective of Tottenham failing that means he's not getting the opportunities. I mean, this just did very little, I think, to suggest that Spurs are heading in anywhere other than backwards.
It's interesting. You talk about Harry Kane's stats. They go to Liverpool next, right? And Solskjaer played two very quick centre forwards. Is there a case for playing Moura and Son on Sunday for Tottenham?
And leaving,
I mean,
Kane out.
Massive. It's a statement. It obviously won't happen. There is no chance it will happen. But
or even playing Kane in a lot deeper. Yeah.
Possible. Dele Alli scored and looked slightly better than he'd looked recently. If we're trying to find some positives for Tottenham, the goal came, as you said, it was slightly unfortunate. It was sort of poor defending between Firmino and Foster. And Foster probably should have just cleared everyone out. Then it hits Dele Alli somewhere around the shoulder bicep area. It's a decent finish. The ref gave the goal. VAR checked it, gave a goal. The screen said no goal. A great statement from Hawkeye, which said, Hawkeye apologises to Spurs and Watford fans for the confusion caused when an incorrect graphic was sent to the big screen. We are working together with the PGMOL and the Premier League to understand the root cause of the problem and propose measures to ensure it won't happen again. Can't they just say someone pressed the wrong button?
Well, I'd imagine that's exactly what happened. Someone pointed, you know, absentmindedly pointed the arrow of their mouse at the wrong button and clicked.
I was watching BT Sports sort of score service on Saturday, and the only reason I watch it is for Peter Walton content because I find him hilarious. And he was in the process of agreeing that the goal should have been chalked off, and then changed his mind and agreed that it definitely should have stood when he realised that the screen had showed the wrong graphic.
Peter Walton's sort of a human equivalent of VAR in that he always just agrees with what's going on.
Exactly.
So this if we haven't seen anything here for Spurs to turn around, this is a home game against a team that have not won all season. How deep is this malaise?
That's very deep. There's something fundamentally broken there. I think the only question now is, do you clear out the sort of five or six players who clearly don't want to be there in the last years of their contracts, or do you clear out Pochettino? And I think you can only decide which the right of those two, or maybe both. And you only decide which the right option is by sitting down with Pochettino and seeing where his head is. And if he's sort of thinking, actually, I want another challenge, then he goes. If he thinks, no, I believe in what I've built, I want to go on to the next stage, but we do need this big clear out, then you do that.
And it's just limp through until December, right? Or till the transfer
probably,
window.
Well, probably
January.
Till next summer. I mean, I don't think you know, make changes that big in January. History suggests you can make one or two important signings in January, but no more than that. And I think this is sort of a failure that's been coming. I think Pochettino has been sort of signalling the last sort of year or two his demands for new signings. Yeah, he was right, and that's not necessarily even making the squad better. It's just that issue of staleness if you have the same people there all the time.
Barry, would you say Spurs have chosen a good season to be the next team to let the cameras in for the Amazon All or Nothing documentary?
I think they have in terms of...
Not nothing, it'll be.
Yes. Making the documentary entertaining. You know, no one wants to watch a documentary about a team being successful. Failure is far more entertaining. Two of the best such documentaries ever made have been about Sunderland, and in both of them they got relegated and had pretty calamitous seasons.
Third one coming out in February,
Which could also be
well, no, because it was about last season. So it was about failure of a different kind, losing twice at Wembley.
Nothing says that's a documentary I want to sit down with my wife and watch than consolidating your position in League One.
Well, losing,
I'm not sure consolidation was really the word that was being used.
Anyway, Spurs host Red Star Belgrade on Tuesday. That's not straightforward.
Not the way they're playing. I mean, Red Star, not great away from home in terms of Europe, tend to do most of their best work at home. If you have a look at sort of last group stage, they were heavily beaten in their three away trips, all difficult ones in Paris, Liverpool, and away to Napoli. One sort of slight bit of defence, really, for Pochettino, maybe, is that he hasn't been able to get Ndombele, Lo Celso and Sessegnon, the three sort of summer signings that were supposed to rejuvenate that team, into the side yet properly. So maybe he'll be sort of waiting for that.
Leicester 2, Burnley 1. Good game, this. Sean Dyche not happy after the game with the Johnny Evans own goal, ruled out because of a trip by Chris Wood. Correct decision? Sean said afterwards, look, Chris Wood doesn't look at Johnny Evans when he trips. He doesn't make a sly look at Johnny Evans, but
I don't think that's the point.
That matters, does it?
I mean, I think the point is, there clearly is some contact.
Mm-hmm.
Is that enough for Johnny Evans to go over the way he did? I don't really know, to be honest. And I would actually say that's an instance where the referee on the pitch should make that decision. I don't think VAR can say to him there probably was a bit of contact, but he must have seen that, right? He must be aware that Johnny Evans, who has at least a chance of getting to the ball, isn't going to just go flat on his face without a reason.
I mean, Johnny Evans said he thought he would have got the ball. That, I think, is not the case.
I agree with you, but there is a chance, right? You can't say definitively he would not have got it. I think the odds are against him, but I think there was a possibility he could have got there.
Do we think that, that there's been mentioned that this monitor, maybe they just got a job lot of tellies that don't work, but the referees have not looked at the monitors. That's something that when I went to that thing in Stockley Park, they said, we don't want to use that because it slows the game down. Is this a case when the ref should have gone over or not?
Yeah, I think so.
But surely, I think if you do it for that instance, then why don't you do it for the Watford penalty?
Well, I think
Tottenham?
You should.
Yeah, I mean,
and also, this is a problem where, you get this sort of mission creep with VAR. The Watford penalty, I think, was a penalty, but I also think that Danny Rose was fouled by Pereira. So that should also be a penalty. So, I mean, it wasn't quite as obvious as... And then you start to deal not in matters of is it a foul or not, but how obvious is the foul, and that just complicates everything further.
Can I just check, regardless of VAR, the laws of football, this idea that Sean Dyche saying that Chris Wood didn't necessarily mean to do it, I mean, it's really irrelevant. You could be one of those, there's that big bumbling thinking of Mice and Men that kept sitting on puppies and killing them, or Lenny in Of Mice and Men, right? He didn't mean to kill all those puppies, but he still did it. If Chris Wood runs into somebody, it's still a foul, even if he means to do it or not. Intent is not... Am I getting the laws of football wrong?
I think footballers and football managers look at these things in a different way to quite a lot of us who aren't footballers do.
I'd certainly be interested in the focus group where you give copies of Of Mice and Men to a series of Premier League managers and see whether they think Lenny is culpable of a homicide at the end and whether George was right to, spoiler alert, to shoot him.
If, say, Ben Mee had been tripped up in that situation, I don't think that Sean Dyche would have said that it was an accident and the goal should have stood.
Who's going to be the one to take Chris Wood down to the river? Right. Producer John, that's true. I mean, Ashley Barnes is, they're both... there's lots of Lennies in the Burnley squad. Anyway, Leicester are now third. It's a lovely header from Jamie Vardy. Great cross from Harvey Barnes as well. Great strike from Youri Tielemans.
He's a good player, isn't he?
Ah, lovely player. Only three of their games this side of Christmas are against teams in the top half. They've got no European football. Their squad looks so balanced, Mark. What's the ceiling?
Oh, I would say...
Third is the ceiling, right?
Third is the ceiling. I'm just looking at some of the underlying numbers, and they're not as rosy as what it actually looks like when you see the league table, because they're 17th in the shots on target table. Now, for a team that's third and you think that they're playing this great, wonderful football and a lot of attacking intent, to be that low down shots on target surprised me and suggests that there's kind of a hiccup coming. I then looked at they've had some marginal calls on VAR with the Wolves handball against them, the Tottenham offside,
yeah.
Then obviously that Burnley one as well. So it could have looked different, but the fact that they are winning and that there's maybe more to come, I think, from this Leicester team. I think performances can still improve. So given the problems elsewhere in the Premier League, no reason why they can't aim for top four.
No team even close to Leicester in terms of outperforming their XG. They're the new Burnley.
In terms of goals scored?
Yes.
So what we said about Liverpool is in terms of points gained according to XG for goals scored and goals conceded.
What the hell are you on about?
Right, Barry, every team has an XG value for goals scored.
Yes.
And also an XG value for goals conceded.
Right.
So Leicester score a lot more goals than their XG would suggest they should.
Okay.
Liverpool also score a lot more, but not quite as many more as Leicester, but they concede fewer. And so when you put them into the actual games, Liverpool are getting more points against their XG than Leicester.
Okay. And we have a league table. Why?
I suddenly feel like George and of Mice and Men. Lenny, just put
well, I should probably admit I've never read of Mice and Men.
We'll go to a farm where there's lots of rabbits and we'll have a lovely time. Just calm down.
I am calm.
That's what Lenny said. Chelsea 1, Newcastle 0. After Liverpool's defeat, Chelsea now hold the longest current winning run in the Premier League with 3 in a row. They're 4th, same points as Leicester. Jonathan Wilson, are you re-evaluating your thoughts on Frank Lampard?
Well, because he kept a clean sheet against Newcastle? No. Of course not.
All right.
The finger wag.
Yeah.
I think you saw the deficiencies of Frank Lampard in how poor Mason Mount was for England. That he did not know how to fulfil his defensive role in that midfield, causing all kinds of chaos.
The sort of common knowledge was that it was Gareth Southgate's fault for putting him into a position that he wasn't totally familiar
with. I also think that was problematic. But I think there's a... I mean, I obviously this is totally speculative, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't surprise me if he was not performing... Even when he was pushed back in that sort of left-sided midfield role, if he was not performing that in the way that Southgate had thought he might.
Didn't Gareth Southgate's looking at Mason Mount going, why are you not... looking behind you? Why are you not tracking back? What's happened to you?
Yeah, I think he probably is thinking that.
Chelsea's fixtures has been pretty kind so far. All of their 5 wins came against teams in the bottom half of the table, 4 of them against the current bottom 5. Wynn says, anyone else sick of Chelsea getting credit for using young players? They've been forced into it because they broke the rules. They don't even have the youngest average age.
Who does?
It is Arsenal.
Really?
A work experience, Ben said so, and we've checked the tape, yes, we've checked the facts. So Arsenal have the youngest average age. No one's giving them the credit that we're all giving Frank Lampard, Mark.
I mean, this was a case at Derby as well, where Frank Lampard was getting maybe a little bit more praise than he possibly deserved, but he doesn't have to play Tammy Abraham over Olivier Giroud. He didn't need to get rid of David Luiz. Callum Hudson-Odoi is playing maybe instead of a more experienced player on the wing. So I still feel like he is trying to give youth a chance. I think we'll see more of Reece James as the season goes on as well. So no, I wouldn't knock him for that. I mean, maybe the praise is a little bit OTT, but Chelsea have surprised me. I didn't expect them to be as good as they are. Albeit that, as you mentioned, their fixture list has been quite kind.
I would agree with that. I do think they are doing better than I expected, but Frank Lampard doesn't have to do much to get praise from the media, does he?
Does for me.
The further you get away from it, the weirder that 4-0 defeat to Manchester United on the opening day.
It was a weird game. You could see even at the time it was a weird game.
Yeah.
I mean, I think United played much better yesterday than they did in that game.
Anyway, Chelsea go to Ajax on Wednesday at one of the early kickoffs. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll round up the rest of the Premier League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly live shows, Barry. We're off to the Science Museum next week, sold out. November the 27th, Indigo at the O2. Me, you, Jonathan Wilson, Ellis James. It's going to be a classic, isn't it?
It is. I hope. Will there be anyone there?
Yes, selling okay now. That's
good,
the that's what
come
I've got.
Come along, everyone.
Don't know
Thank
how you,
you
define okay, but that's good. You looking forward to it, Jonathan?
Very much so, yeah.
Are you looking forward to the 20th of December as well?
Oh, yeah.
Belgrave Music Hall. Me, you, Lars, and one other.
Yeah, no, I mean, nothing could fill me with more joy than playing Leeds on a Friday night just before Christmas.
Mm.
So the first time we played Leeds when I was there, that sold out almost instantly.
Mm-hmm.
This one still hasn't sold out.
What are you suggesting, Barry?
I'm not suggesting anything. I'm just curious to know why Leeds people are suddenly reluctant not to go to Football Weekly Live for the one that I'm not involved
what
in.
What I will say to the people of Leeds is anything you really want to know about Barry, we will tell you, warts and all. Including a great anecdote he told me about being in a lake in Exeter just before this pod began. January the 27th, we've sold out Liberty Hall in Dublin, me and you, Baz, plus a couple of others. Guess what?
What?
We're doing another one. We're doing one on the 28th too.
Okay.
So come to both. And if you just want to come to one and you didn't get a ticket, come to the one on the 28th. Both nights will be equally fantastic. Let's go to Selhurst Park. Crystal Palace 0, Manchester City 2. Manchester City played with 2 central midfielders at centre-back. Is David Silva's goal the best thing the Premier League delivered this weekend, Mark Langdon?
Yeah, I think so. It was the assist. Well, actually, it started before that. It was such a quick counter-attack. Kevin De Bruyne played a forward pass even before that. It was one of the few times that Palace sort of ventured into City's half in that first half, and City absolutely killed them. And the assist from Sterling, followed by the volley from David Silva, was just world-class.
Is Manchester City's away kit the worst thing the Premier League delivered this weekend, Barry Glendening?
I would say second worst after the Vertonghen non-penalty.
No, it's the kit.
The kit is so terrible.
I mean, Vertonghen was, you know, was only sort of 2 feet from getting the ball. That kit was no justification for it whatsoever.
Would you like to hear the PR about the strip, everyone?
Yeah.
It is a gradient yellow and peach design third kit, quote, inspired by the on-field brilliance of Manchester City's style of football, vibrant, disruptive and daring.
It's definitely daring.
Or shite. I mean, it's...
it's Puma, isn't it?
I think so.
It's fine. It's great. It's lovely. And I'm not just saying that because I've done some consultancy work for Puma and would like some more. It's a brilliant kit and everybody should wear it.
Did everyone enjoy how angry Kevin De Bruyne was when Gabriel Jesus didn't square the ball to him? I can't think of a moment where someone should have squared it more obviously in that the pass was so easy and the finish from Jesus was tricky and he obviously didn't score.
Yeah, well, maybe... You know, you never know what you're going to get with De Bruyne. Would you trust him to slot that one home from 4 yards out?
He's such an unbelievable footballer, isn't he?
He's brilliant. I mean...
He's got twice as many assists as anybody else in Premier League this season.
There you go.
There you go.
Gabriel Jesus, apart from that, had a very good game, and Pep still kind of singled him out for criticism for that, among other things, after the game.
Is De Bruyne the best midfielder on earth?
At the moment, I'd say. Best attacking midfielder at the moment, yeah.
All right. Well done, Kevin. De Bruyne, I think, was taken down for another one of those penalties.
He was shoved by Wilf Zaha.
Yeah.
And should have got a penalty.
Anyway, but he didn't. But City won. Back on the horse after that game against Wolves. They host Atalanta on Tuesday night. To Villa Park. Villa 2, Brighton 1. Aaron Moy was sent off after 35 minutes. Adam Webster had put Brighton ahead. Mark, what is Aaron Moy doing twice?
It was ridiculous. Cost Brighton the game. They were the better team up until that point. I mean, the first one, I think, is the more foolish one. I never understand why, particularly in such a it wasn't a dangerous area. It wasn't like there was a big counter-attack on where you feel like maybe you have to do that. That was the foolish one. And then,
but people have been getting away with that this season. I have a tiny bit of sympathy in that it seems to come back in the game and refs aren't penalising it. I mean, I think it should be bookable, and I've got no problems with him getting booked, but he can turn around and say, well, hang on, there's a dozen other examples, or more than that this season, where players haven't been booked for that. So I think referees should take a harder line on it.
Both of Villa's goals in injury time, one in the first half, one in the second half, just sickening times to concede.
Yeah, well, Brighton have only themselves to blame because they were in possession of the ball deep in injury time. I don't know who the guilty party was, so I can't name a shame.
Probably David Ginola.
Humped the ball down the field, gave Villa possession, and then they went up and scored.
Such an unlike Graham Potter side to sort of do that as well, because they still, I think, shaded the possession even though they were down to 10 men. So, yeah, sort of not the thing that he would be teaching the players at that point. Maybe they just sort of ran out of steam and it just felt like a tired thing to do.
Jake says, as a Villa fan, should I be worried about losing Mings, McGinn and Grealish in January or the summer, all been linked to Manchester United? I mean, Jack Grealish was the star for Villa again. Whenever he's mentioned, you know, the question is, could he do it at a big club? Should we just enjoy him being good at Aston Villa?
Oh, well, I'm enjoying him being good at Aston Villa. Everyone talks about players, you know, they might go to Manchester United. Are players going to want to go to Manchester United? You know, if I was Jack Grealish, I would, with the greatest respect, rather go to a bigger club and a more successful club than Manchester United, who look like they're in a, you know, well, they are in a period of turmoil. And obviously they see possibly Jack Grealish or Harry Kane or whoever as parts of the solution. But I think I'd, you know, Jack Grealish has the world at his feet. I'd rather go somewhere else.
Mm, he's been linked to Spurs, but he probably doesn't want to go there either, does he?
But he's also done it for, 2 months in the Premier League? Like, I think he... I'm not saying he doesn't have the quality. I just sort of think he probably should have at least a year at Villa to kind of make sure that he can keep playing at that level and actually enjoy playing at that level.
2 months is all you need to court interest from the big boys.
Just the modern football, isn't it? Because it just means if you're a fan of one of those clubs who isn't one of the absolute giants, there's no point emotionally investing in any player because you'll either be rubbish and therefore you'll stay, or you'll be terrible, or you'll be brilliant and we'll get plucked away from you.
Hasn't it always kind of been thus?
Not to the level it is now. You know, you could keep hold of a decent player for 2 or 3 seasons.
Everton 2, West Ham 0. Barry, you said it was the meh derby on Thursday. West Ham stuck to the script, didn't they? But Everton were really good.
Everton were really good and West Ham were diabolically bad. I suppose there was always going to be the possibility of that. Marcus Silva made, I think it was 5 changes to Everton. Tom Davis, who I'm a big, big fan of, I have to say. He got his first start of the season and was outstanding in midfield for Everton. Him and Andre Gomes in central midfield kind of ran proceedings, and Everton were well worth their win, but weren't up against much.
I just sort of think Everton are full of players who are good if you let them be good. It's like Iwobi, Walcott.
Who both were really good.
Richarlison, even Sigurdsson when he came for bench.
But what do you mean by let them be good?
If you give them space, don't get in their faces.
Oh, right, the opposition, not Marco Silva, right.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. If the opposition don't get tight to them, they will be good because they're good players. But they sort of lack it, I don't know, whether it's a streetwiseness, whether it's a toughness. You wouldn't trust any of them in a real battle of a game.
And it's consistency, right? I mean, one part is being good and one part is being good, like you say about Greed. It's been good again and again and again and again. Sigurdsson's goal was just a thing of total beauty. To Molineux, Wolves won, Southampton won. Wolves go from winning at City to drawing at home to Southampton. They had this problem last season where they were good against good teams and bad against bad teams. Why, Mark?
I think it's the way that they're set up to play, on the counter-attack mainly. They only managed the one shot on target that actually counted in this game. I mean, they did sort of, they were a little bit unlucky, I suppose, with the Cotrone shot where he was just offside and Jimenez knocked it in. You know, there wasn't much in that one, and you know, I think last season that would have counted, wouldn't it, that goal? But that they are a team that's set up, I think, predominantly to play on the counter-attack, so when they're expected to dominate, it becomes harder to play that way.
I was having lunch with my friend Martin, who works in pensions and is a season ticket holder at Molineux, and he was just talking about the psychological blow within the stadium and for the team as well when you have a goal disallowed by VAR, because it's, you know, they had one disallowed on the pitch, the handball, and they had one by VAR, and just the amount of time it takes and the psychological boost it gives to the opposing player as well.
Well, kind of Cody spoke about it, didn't he? And he said the first one, he was like, okay, Tambor, we can all sort of understand that. The second one, he actually said to the ref, is it okay? And the ref going, oh, yeah. And only then does the decision come. So I think that's the harder one, when you're lined up ready to kick off again and suddenly it's choked off. And, you know, he said it is difficult.
Something that players just have to learn, right? Cricketers have kind of learnt that, haven't they? You just got to get on with it.
Brendan Rodgers spoke about this, didn't he, after Leicester's victory over Tottenham. It's something that they've spoken about at length in trying to get the mentality right for when decisions are going either way. And of course, that game changed, you know, quite heavily on a VAR moment too.
So does that mean that Brendan Rodgers says, right, lads, training's over, I'm taking you all out for a lovely lunch and a few drinks? And they're like, yes. No, I'm not. Do another 10 laps.
It's that SAS show, isn't it? When they run, you know, they do a marathon through the night and they get in. Just as they get to the truck drives away. Brendan Rodgers laughing at the wheel. Bournemouth 0, Norwich 0. Teemu Pukki had a good shot, pushed around the post. 4 league games without a goal for him now. Both teams kept their first clean sheet of the season in the league. And that's pretty much it from that game, unless anyone has a say.
You looked at me pleadingly, as if, you know, have you got anything? Have you?
Has anyone got
anything? I'll be honest, I'd lost interest in Match of the Day at this stage.
I think just to say that Norwich had quite a few players come back from injury, and, you know, that
Tim Krul, yeah.
Yeah, so that I think is important for them. You know,
they were ravaged.
Exactly, you know, to come back from that 5-1 against Aston Villa with a clean sheet, I think, you know, it could be an important point come the end of the season.
Tonight, 8 o'clock kickoff, Sheffield United versus Arsenal at Bramall Lane. Big headline to come out Before this game, Ollie McBurney has been charged with drink driving. He was arrested in the early hours of Friday morning. He'll appear before magistrates in Leeds next month. He was due to return to the team tonight after recovering from a knee injury. The club has not put out a statement as of time of recording. Into the Football League, West Brom are top of the Championship after a 1-0 win at Middlesbrough. Hal Robson-Kanu with a goal 8 minutes from time. Leeds in second also won. It was Calvin Phillips' second half strike to give him a 1-0 win at home to Birmingham. Did anyone see Bielsa in a Leeds tracksuit at the 100-year celebration? Yeah. Everyone else in this sort of team photo type thing is in posh black tie, and there he is in his Leeds garb. I mean, you've got to love him, haven't you? We mentioned on Thursday that none of the top 10 were playing each other. Most of them didn't win, though. Aside from the top two, only QPR did. 3-2 at Hull with two late penalties. Charlton now up to seventh after beating Derby. Two wins in a row now means Stoke are off the bottom. 2-0 over Fulham. James writes, in the latest episode of Transfers You Might Have Missed, I've just seen Danny Simpson in a Huddersfield shirt.
Okay.
Certainly passed me by. And I learnt this morning that Charlie Adam plays for Reading.
I knew that.
Oh, well done.
I was wondering, actually, after Stoke won their first game, what price you'd get on them being promoted this season. Or even now.
It's interesting. Well, Nathan Jones...
Because I've never seen a manager talk with such self-belief in his methods. And he clearly did a good job at Luton.
Mm-hmm.
And got off to this horror start. And I think...
But I've heard him speak... Like, before these two victories, I've heard him speak... Basically, as sort of planning where to rent his next house. Yeah. You know, like he literally
but
totally
also
moved.
Saying, I firmly believe in what I'm doing. I know this will work if I'm given time. And they appear to have turned a corner.
33-1.
Right, okay.
On Barry's beloved expected goals, Stoke were actually doing quite a bit better than what the league table suggested, which maybe plays into both of those kind of points where Jones knew that they were playing okay, but also knew that he was probably one more result away from the sack. I think had they not won that game before the international break, it would have been very difficult for Stoke to
hold on. I would like to stress I have nothing against expected goals. I just genuinely didn't know what they were talking about earlier.
Bristol City are investigating reports that a small group of their supporters engaged in racist chanting towards Luton fans during their game on Saturday. Bristol City owner Steve Lansdowne said that anyone found guilty of behaving in a racist manner will be banned from attending their games home and away. In League One, the only unbeaten team in the Football League lost their record yesterday. Ipswich going down 2-0 at Accrington Stanley. They're still top. Wycombe Wanderers are second. They beat Sunderland on Phil Parkinson's first game in charge. League Two, result of the day.
I prefer to think of that one as Gareth Ainsworth's not first game in charge.
See, that's that. I think the three big, and I use the word quite inaccurately, the three big North Eastern sides had between them a combined 7 shots on target at the weekend, and I think 6 of them were by Middlesbrough.
That's an excellent stat. League Two, result of the day. Cambridge United's 4-0 win over Exeter. How much time can I spend on this game? Not very much. Exeter dropped to fourth because of that defeat. They were joint top with Crewe, who are now there on their own. Wins also for Bradford and Newport, who make up the top three. Probably the most sobering, depressing story from the weekend was at Haringey Borough. Reports of racist abuse in their FA Cup fourth qualifying round against Yeovil. Halfway through the second half, Yeovil won a penalty and scored it, around which time Haringey goalkeeper Valerie Douglas-Pajatat was allegedly spat at and hit by an object thrown from the Yeovil town end. Defender Kobe Rowe was then racially abused, according to the Haringey boss Tom Loazu, who said there was no way I could let him continue. He then took his players off the pitch. Kobe Rowe sent a tweet after the game saying, "Can't believe I'm tweeting this and it's 2019, but today I was a victim of racism in what was supposed to be a great day for Haringey Borough Football Club. Another game of football ruined by racist. Thanks to Yeovil Town players and staff who backed our decision to leave the pitch." Police this morning arrested two men, one aged 23 and one aged 26, in Chard and Yeovil on suspicion of racially aggravated common assault. They remain in custody at the time of recording. Loazu, speaking to the BBC after the game, said, "The abuse a few of my players got was disgusting. Yeovil's players and managers were a different class. Their team tried to calm their supporters down. They tried their best and they supported us. They said, if you're walking off, we're walking off with you. I took the decision to take my team off, and I don't want Yeovil Town to get punished for it. If we get thrown out of the FA Cup and they go through, there is no hard feelings there. I've not done it for any other reason than looking into my players' faces and seeing how distraught they were. They are not used to this. The FA is also investigating, said it was deeply concerned about the allegations. There's no room for discrimination in our game, they said, and we are working with match officials and the relevant authorities as a matter of urgency to fully establish the facts and take the appropriate steps. Now, look, we obviously discuss how to cover these stories on the pod before we go on air. Firstly, we want to point to the special we did last Wednesday where we went in depth. That wasn't the first time we've talked about it. Just to make it clear, that won't be the last time either. We all know it is still happening in this country as well as elsewhere. We will do pods like that again. In slightly happier news from the FA Cup, has everybody seen the Billericay Town goalkeeper, Alan Julian? He went up for a free kick against Sutton United when they were a goal down and scored a header to ensure that their neighbours in the hat for the FA Cup first round. And it was not a bad header at all, went right in the corner. It takes him about a second to realise what's happened. And then his hand goes straight, like proper Alan Shearer, sprinting off until every single member of his team and squad jump on top of him. Lovely moment.
Good for him. Jamie O'Hara is manager of Billericay, isn't he?
I think he tweeted that it was something like the greatest. He felt like it was the greatest moment of his entire footballing career.
I thought you was going to mention the when you talk about the FA Cup with Chichester through to the first round, and they celebrated in some style at a service station.
Oh yes, I saw that
a video that's gone viral. Yeah.
Well, were they all? They're all singing and dancing with their £4 ginsters and something else.
It probably would have been a lively coach trip home, I think.
To women's football now. United won the Manchester Derby in the WSL Cup, beating City 2-0, ending City's perfect start to the season. Katie Zellum and Jess Sigworth with the goals. Arsenal beat Charlton 4-0, including a banger from Beth Mead from near enough the corner flag. She must have been wearing Predators, the amount of curl on that ball. Lewis of the Championship very nearly won at Reading of the WSL, but Farrah Williams grabbed a hat-trick for the home side, scoring her third at the death as they won 3-2. West Ham were trailing 2-0 against Spurs, heading into injury time, then scored twice to level the score and grab a point. The format of the competition meant they then had to have a penalty shootout that determined the winner of the further point, if that makes sense to you, which Spurs won 4-2. There were easy wins for Liverpool, Aston Villa and London Bees. To fit bar, Barry.
Celtic hammered Ross County and Rangers sojourn at the top of the SPL was brief, to say the least. They could only draw away at Hearts, who outfought them, out scrapped them, were more tenacious and got a point from a match I don't think anyone was expecting them to win. Celtic the previous day had beaten Ross County 6-0, like just a routine slaughter. And Rangers, their form away from home is a source of concern, has been for a while now, and I think only two of their next eight games in all competitions are at Ibrox, so that will be quite revealing. I think it's a bit early to say whether or not we will have a title race, proper title race in Scotland, but it would be great if we could have one.
Hearts have opened an investigation after claims that Alfredo Morelos was racially abused after he equalised. Police Scotland say they're unaware of any complaints, with the only arrest being made for a separate incident. A statement from the club. The club is aware of an incident of alleged racism, is currently investigating it. It goes without saying that Heart of Midlothian Football Club utterly condemns any form of racism, and any individuals found guilty of such an offence will face an indefinite ban from Tynecastle. Should just point out Lee Ashcroft's volley for Dunfermline. Absolute zinger. Right in the corner, somebody tweeted, is Lee Ashcroft better than Zidane? No. But even still, it was a really good hit. And that is where we'll end part two. We'll begin part three in Spain with Sidlow. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. And we'll start in Spain, as we always do, with Sidlow. Sid, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Now, before anything, let's talk El Clásico. It was meant to be this Saturday. It's been postponed due to the civil unrest in Barcelona. Today, the competition committee is announcing a new date, but that's not the end of it, is it?
It's not going to be the end of it, no. And it really should be. And in a way, it's kind of comic, this, because this the whole idea of not playing the Clásico this weekend, or at least not playing it at the Camp Nou, was put forward by Javier Tebas, the president of the league. And now, effectively, he doesn't like the solution to that. So he's the one that creates the situation. Well, I say creates the situation, responds to what's happening in Catalonia to suggest that it shouldn't be played at the Camp Nou this weekend. But then, of course, his proposed solution isn't taken on board and he doesn't like the one that is. So to put this into context, what happens is that the league writes to the federation. And this is the other part of this, and you know, kind of worth keeping this line in mind. It writes to the federation to ask for this game to be switched, for the two Clásicos to be turned over. In other words, instead of playing at the Camp Nou this time and the Bernabeu in March, they would play at the Bernabeu this time and the Camp Nou in March, in which, in the meantime, of course, the idea being that things would calm down and there wouldn't be so much tension and there wouldn't be any potential problems. This gets sent to the Federation. The Federation say, OK, we'll put this into the hands of the Competition Committee. The Competition Committee, which is a three-member committee that has Federation representation on it, has La Liga representation on it, and it has independent representation on it. And they say, we're going to hear from the two clubs, we're going to listen to what they say, and then we're going to take a decision. At that point, what everybody's saying is that the clubs can say what they want to do, but they won't actually necessarily get what they want. The Competition Committee decides that it's not going to turn the games around. It's not going to switch the Clásicos around. I mean, there's lots of reasons for not doing it, although they haven't given an actual reason themselves why. But obviously, you know, changing tickets over and all that sort of stuff is of course really quite difficult. They say they're going to listen to the two clubs. Barcelona don't want to change the game at all. They want to play at home. They want to play and they want to play now. Real Madrid say, look, we don't want to switch the two Clásicos over and invert the order of them, but maybe we could postpone this. The Competition Committee says, okay, we'll postpone this. And they then say, we're going to give the two clubs until Monday to come up with an agreement. So having originally, you know, kind of let it be known that it wouldn't be down to the clubs, they're then saying it will be down to the clubs. If they don't agree, we'll take a decision. Both Barcelona and Real Madrid, with incredible speed and you know, kind of pleasantly surprising how kind of calm and relaxed it all was, they both say, yeah, okay, 18th of December. And that is what will be announced in the next hour or so, if it hasn't already. But what's going to happen is the league's going to say no. And the league's going to say no because that's a Wednesday night and they wanted this on a Saturday at 1 o'clock for the Asian TV market. And it's also on the night of the Copa del Rey, the Copa del Rey that has no Champions League teams in it at the moment. So it is a free game. It is a free day for these two clubs. So I think we're going to have a fight now and I think it will probably go to court. They're going to try and just kind of block it completely, the league. But of course, as I say, this is of their making. If Tebas had basically put this in the hands of the Ministry of the Interior or the security and police forces in Barcelona, then the chances are this game, although it might have been tense, would have gone ahead anyway.
Is it strange to have Real Madrid and Barcelona then sort of agreeing and fighting together against the Spanish Federation? Because I might be wrong here. I sort of wondered if Barcelona versus Real Madrid politically sort of represents the two sides of the political debate as well.
Well, of course it does in many ways. But the first thing to say here is that Barcelona and Real Madrid are not fighting against the Federation. They're fighting against the league. And that's the other, if you like, contextual point here. And I don't want to bore you, so I'm going to try and put it in really simple terms. The league and the Federation absolutely effing hate each other. And there is a war going on for jurisdiction, for power, which is incredibly nasty, which basically at every available opportunity, there's some sort of conflict. And so I think this can be seen in that context, in the context of another power struggle between the Federation and the league for control, for authority of Spanish football, essentially. And I think that's fundamentally the position we're in now.
On the pitch, would you say Real Madrid are lucky to dodge El Clásico? Barcelona won 3-0 at Eibar. Real Madrid lost 1-0 at Mallorca.
Yeah, I mean, it is only Real Madrid's first defeat of the season. But in a way, the question mark has been this weekend, why is it the only their first defeat of the season in La Liga? Because they haven't actually played very well at all. Like, I can't think of a single game where they played well for the entire match. We've had a couple of good halves, but not a game away through. They were good for a bit against Granada, good for a bit against Levante, but there hasn't been much from Madrid that convinces. In truth, there hasn't been a huge amount from Barcelona, but this weekend they were very good. I think the main reason why this probably helps Real Madrid is the injuries. You know, they were likely to have gone to the Camp Nou this weekend with key players out. I think both Modric and Bale probably wouldn't have made it. They now have that week off, and obviously, you know, they've got time to find their feet again. So yeah, in theory at least, in footballing terms, this probably does help Real Madrid. But I think it's worth pointing out again, you know, these two clubs agreed on postponement dates. I don't think at least that footballing criteria were a big part of the thinking of either club. It's worth pointing out as well, sorry, and this is kind of slightly going back on ourselves, but I think fundamentally, and one of the things that Tebas isn't admitting to the president of the league, is the main reason he was trying to avoid this was not so much about security, although I think that's part of it, but that he didn't want the Clásico, his product, which he always describes as being kind of a reflection of brand Spain, Marca España, he calls it, this idea that we're extolling Spanish virtues in the world. He didn't want that product, of course, becoming a platform for Catalan independence, kind of political, what's the word, reivindicaciones, what do you call that in English? Statements, I suppose.
Sure. Atletico drew for the fourth game in 5-1-1 against Valencia. What's the chat about them? Are they feeling under pressure?
Yes, they are. And Simeone was very pointed post-game. He said, I knew this would be a difficult season. He'd said something similar in an interview with Cadenasera, I think 7 or 8 days before. And he said, you know, lots of people got very excited very early with us, but I knew this was a transitional season with a whole load of new players that are young players and we need to get it right. And it wasn't going to be easy. And he said, and this was the pointed bit, he said, anyone who wants to work and find solutions will be okay with me, but anyone who wants to look for excuses will not. And that was seen, I think, as a dig at maybe some fans, maybe some at boardroom level, maybe some media. But I think the fact that he's talking about working with me suggests that this is about some players as well. And yet the curious thing is, their problem is up front. And Costa and Morata, you know, just a pretty poor partnership. It doesn't fit very well. They're not scoring goals. It's first time Costa scored a penalty. First time he scored at home in over a year, in the whole of 2019. And so they're the ones that are perhaps more than anyone else not performing particularly well. And yet they're the ones that Simeone, at least publicly, is defending.
And finally, what's wrong with Betis? Lost 3-1 at Sociedad, have lost half their games in 2019. They were your team to watch at the start of last season, Sid.
They are always a team to watch. They're great to watch. And by the way, the team they played against, Real Sociedad, are a brilliant team to watch as well. They're so exciting. They're quick. They're dynamic. They're great on the ball. Odegaard's playing brilliantly. Marino's really good in the middle midfield. Oyarzabal as well. So I think what happened to Betis was that they came up against a better team. But it is true that they haven't found a way of getting the pieces to fit yet. And at the weekend, they basically played all of their forward players, and they went 1-0 up. So in theory, at least, oh look, this is going to work. But they got blown apart by a team that I think is probably the best team in Spain at the moment. It's certainly in terms of best team to watch.
Is Elzi Ardiles their manager? I love the idea of Spain. Always, just put all my attackers in. Why not?
Yeah, well, I mean, and this is the thing about this, of course. I mean, I don't know how sort of on top of this you were last year, but of course their coach for the previous 2 years being a guy called Quique Setién, known for being incredibly offensive in the way that he wants to play, putting players on the pitch, being very puritanical about touch and technique and style and being attacking and not just sitting back. And people always say, well, look at you, you're letting in loads of goals, you're so naive. And now the new manager, I think they've conceded 5 twice, they conceded 3 this weekend, they're the team with the worst defensive record in the league. So you sort of think, sorry, wasn't this all Quique Setién's fault?
Hey, listen, Sid, have fun. If that was your doorbell, go and answer it. We'll speak to you soon.
Cheerio.
Sid Lowe there, out in Spain. In Germany, none of the top 8 going into this weekend won. Dortmund were the biggest beneficiaries. They climbed to 4th with a 1-0 win over leaders Mönchengladbach. Bayern Munich, one of 6 sides who could have found themselves top with a win. They were held to a surprise 2-2 draw by struggling Augsburg, who scored their goals in the first and 91st minutes. Good times to score. Schalke also missed their chance to go top in the Sunday evening game. They lost 2-0 at Hoffenheim. Mark?
Yeah, just in that Bayern Munich game, the result wasn't the only problem. Nicolas Sula suffered a cruciate injury, so going to be out for a long time.
Thank you, Mark. To Italy now, this roundup from Nicky Bandini on another weekend full of goals.
Yes, there were loads of goals in Serie A this weekend, starting right from the very first game, which was Atalanta-Lazio on Saturday afternoon. And I will start with that game because Atalanta playing Man City in the Champions League this week. I think a lot of people who don't watch Serie A might have glanced at their Champions League results this season and concluded that this was one of those classic one-season teams that punches above its weight, reaches the Champions League, and then just gets totally found out. And while they have been bad in Europe, and I mean, they really were dreadful against Dynamo Zagreb, I think they were a bit more lucky against Shakhtar. Atalanta have been really good again this season in Serie A. They're top scorers in the division, only 3 points behind Juventus before this weekend's game away to Lazio, which they wound up drawing 3-3. But they were 3-0 up at half-time for that game, just playing so outrageously well. They'd had 7 shots on goal to Lazio's, none at that point. And their first goal, which is launched by a 1-2 with a back-heel flick in the middle of it by Mario Pasalic, was just such a beautiful team move. The crazier thing almost is that they were missing Duvan Zapata, who's their top scorer for this game. He's also going to miss the City game. They rotated Josip Iličić, who's another important part of the attack, out, but in came Luis Muriel and Ruslan Malinovsky, who are their two big summer signings, and both of them were brilliant. So they've got so many attacking options. I fully expect them to go for it against City. Their captain, Papu Gomez, has said as much. And I fully expect that they're going to get walloped against City as well, because as good as they are going forward, they can be absolutely dire at the back. And they showed that here, giving away 2 very cheap penalties, letting Lazio pick it back to 3-3. If you get a chance, do check out Ciro Immobile's goal celebration after the equaliser, because he tries to rip his shirt off, fails to get it over his head, then falls over sideways and gets booked for his trouble. So a magnificent moment there from Ciro Immobile. Lots else I'd tell you to check out as well, if you haven't seen it already, because as mentioned, there were lots of goals. Inter beat Sassuolo 4-3, but there were also some really, really good ones. Raja Nainggolan just casually crushing a half volley into the top corner from 25 yards. Hakan Çalhanoğlu working a really tight angle for Milan. And Jeremy Boga weaving past, I think, 5 Inter players on his way to scoring Sassuolo's 3rd goal in that match as well. In terms of other headlines, Juventus are still top after they beat Bologna. Gigi Buffon rolling back the years with a great save at the end of that one. Claudio Ranieri came in at Sampdoria, celebrated his 68th birthday by taking charge of his first game there, which was against his former club, Roma. And that was the only 0-0 of the weekend. It's the positive result for Samp, the way their season's going. Milan have a new manager as well, Stefano Pioli, but he could only draw with Lecce. Bad result for Milan, despite going into injury time in the second half with both a goal and a one-man advantage.
Thank you, Nicky. Can we just echo what Nicky said about Nangolan's goal? Because that is, we've been talking about half volleys, and I know he chested it, so I don't know if that officially, it's still a half volley in my mind. It is the purest strike of a football I've seen for such a long time. It stayed ball marked.
It did. Flew into the top corner. Absolutely fantastic goal.
In France, PSG now 5 points clear after a 4-1 win at Nice. Angel Di Maria getting the first 2. Mbappe with 1 on his return from injury. Mauro Icardi with the 4th. Neymar was absent as he picked up a hamstring strain on international duty with Brazil. Looks to be out for a month. A quick note on Nice. You remember the story from a few weeks ago when youth team player Lamine Diaby Fadiga was suspected of stealing a watch from new signing Kasper Dolberg. He admitted it, has been sacked by Nice, released a statement on his Twitter account saying, "I proudly wore my childhood club's shirt last season in Ligue 1. I was then unfortunately injured for several months and my return to competitive action was further delayed following a red card I picked up while playing for the under-19s. That affected me mentally and my difficult situation contrasted starkly with the success and aura of Kasper, my teammate. I took it out on him without having any reason to do so, maybe a bit because of jealousy. Now I'm leaving the club where I had always wanted to succeed and enjoy myself, which for me is the greatest possible punishment." He's since reimbursed Kasper Dolberg for the watch. He has joined Ligue 2 side Paris FC as he attempts to revive his career. Wayne Rooney's MLS career came to an end with a 5-1 defeat in the playoffs. DC United scored a late equaliser to take their meeting with Toronto FC to extra time. Went down 5-1 in the first 15 minutes, which is extraordinary extra time performance, isn't it? Rooney was subbed off at halftime in extra time. But he had a tremendous impact, Wayne Rooney, in MLS. DC United were bottom of the league. He helped them to the playoffs in both seasons. They were knocked out the first hurdle last year too. But you get the sense from local journalists who we've remembered fondly. He scored 23 goals, made 15 assists in 49 games in MLS. Joined Derby in January. How do we think he'll do at Derby County, Jonathan?
Okay, probably.
Okay,
I don't know. I haven't seen him play.
I feel that he was sort of written off. I certainly feel that I sort of wrote when he left. I just thought, well, that's pretty much him done. And I thought he would be one of those MLS players who went and didn't have an impact, like Steven Gerrard didn't really have an impact, as opposed to players who go and do. I don't know if
Robbie
that's unfair.
Keane.
Yeah, Robbie Keane did. Yeah, So I'm just very interested to see how he performs in the Championship. It's a notoriously difficult physical pace.
I'd imagine it would be a lot more difficult for him than MLS.
No. But, Derby have been really struggling as well, which is not going to help if he's supposed to be playing, you know, I suppose as a forward, but...
I think he's already off the road, though, so that might help.
Yeah, I do... you can see him being the next manager of Derby, can't you? I mean, Philip Cocu must be under pressure. You've got an experienced guy coming in that's a player coach.
Is he coming in as player coach, though, or is that not some sort of creative accountancy to help them not break the... FFP.
They've been quite creative with other aspects of their finances, so it wouldn't be a massive surprise. But Cocu is under pressure there, and you know, if you've got somebody like Rooney waiting in the wings, it feels like a sort of natural step, maybe.
Has he done badges or anything? I have no idea. So.
It doesn't stop others.
It's true. Jonathan, you're off to the Super Classico.
Yeah, off tonight. And the game is, well, early hours of Wednesday morning, UK time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the second leg of the Libertadores semi-final. So River would home first, 1-2-0. Boca struggle for goals. I think they've only scored more than two once this season. So you would assume that River will be relatively comfortable. Their coach, Marcelo Gallardo, who... I think he's one of the brightest young coaches in the world. He's only 43, but he's already won the Uruguayan title plus two Libertadores. He's played seven times. You know, he has coached team seven times at La Bombonera and only lost once, which is back in 2015. So you would think River will go through, but you know it will be an incredible atmosphere, I'm sure, and who knows what might happen. And just hopefully it goes ahead. Unlike last year's Superclásico, which I went to twice and didn't see a minute's football.
Yeah, but to be fair, a lot of British journalists got a lot of copy out of those non-games.
Oh, as a freelance, it was the best. I've come to the conclusion that football itself is overrated. The ideal scenario is you go to a game, there's a great crowd there, there's a great atmosphere, you can video it and post it on Twitter and get all your hits and likes and everything. Then there's some massive controversies if the game doesn't happen. You write your piece and you're having a steak by 9:30. It's brilliant.
Liam says, just a brief mention of the Allsvenskan title race. Two games to go and it looks like this. Hammarby are top, played 28, 59 points. Malmo, second, played 28, 59 points. Djurgårdens, third, played 27, 59 points. AIK, fourth, played 28, 59 points. It's absolutely tremendous, isn't it? It's what you dream of.
Yeah, Gordon, is Marcus's club, isn't it?
Yeah.
It means zoo.
It means zoo, does it?
Animal garden, Yeah, Gordon.
Ah, lovely. Zvonimir says, what's your favourite formation? Mark?
Is it the Red Arrows?
I like that Ozzy Ardiles. Well, sort of the five up front, the famous five. No, I think 4-2-3-1 is my favourite formation. I think it gives you balance in all the right areas.
Oh, I want 4-4-2. I want two massive centre-backs, two tiny, very quick full-backs, spindly wingers, a creative centre-mid, and a really dirty one, a 6'8" centre-forward next to a 5'8" centre-forward.
You're just missing your number 10 then, aren't you? You can, in a 4-2-3-1, you can have all of the above, but you're missing that sort of creative genius.
Mark Jeffries, who is the Daily Mirror showbiz editor, says, is Ralph Little the right signing to replace Ardal O'Hanlon on Death in Paradise?
Do you know what concerns me about this?
Okay.
I was troubled as soon as I saw the news because, of course, he was in he was in Death in Paradise in, I think, season two when Ben Miller was there.
Okay.
But not the same character. It was one, do you remember when Neil Pearson was playing a former colleague of Ben Miller? It was that one that he was in. It makes me uncomfortable when actors come back and you know, they're playing two different roles in the same series. Although, speaking of Neil Pearson, I saw A Midsummer Murders over the weekend.
Yes.
It's one of the early Neil Dudgeon ones. I think maybe the first or the second one after he took over from Nettles. And not only was Neil Pearson in it, but also the bloke who played George on Drop the Dead Donkey and Hayden Gwynn from Drop of the Donkey. It was like a Drop of the Donkey reunion. And we didn't reference it at all.
I had a nice chat with Neil Pearson in a McDonald's toilet once. Ralph Little is a very good footballer, just to bring it back to sport.
He's played semi-pro, hasn't he?
Yeah, very good left foot. Slightly mouthy on a pitch, I'll be brutally honest.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, but doesn't like losing, even a game of five-a-side. So he will solve that case, if nothing else. He may not listen to any of his... You know, I think it's going to be tough for his teammates in the police station. On Santa Maria Island, but he'll get the job done.
To be honest,
is the cat from Red Dwarf?
No, he's gone. He went back to see his dad in London. I think it was his dad, anyway.
Yeah, but I don't think he ever recovered from Camille leaving.
No, that was a big shame for him, wasn't he?
Did you know that the original working title for Drop the Dead Donkey was Dead Belgians Don't Count?
I did not.
Well, that is true.
Jake sent us this tweet from AFC Filed on Saturday. It says, there's a stoppage in play as a rather rotund man storms the field topless with a bouquet of flowers. Jake says, has this got anything to do with Barry at all?
No. No one gave me flowers on Saturday. Oh.
But you were on the pitch at AFC Filed running around with your shirt off.
Oh, sorry. He was implying that I was the guy.
I think he may have.
Right, okay. No, nothing. No. I don't even know where Filed is.
Lancashire Coast, someone.
It is.
God, it's a bit nippy.
It's a bit cold.
Running around in the altogether, or near enough altogether.
I love the fact, run on a pitch with a bouquet of flowers. Who's he giving it to?
Do you think drink may have been taken?
Arguably. It's possible, isn't it?
That would be my diagnosis.
Somebody parachuted themselves onto the pitch at Sassuolo versus Inter.
With a bouquet of flowers?
No.
Topless?
He was missing that part. Okay. Maybe it was the same guy, though.
Hard to be topless with a parachute, I think.
Well, you'd be wearing a parachute.
But you're saying the chafing of the...
I'm saying the chafing. Oh. If you've ever jumped out of a plane, the...
No.
The pain when the parachute is... The cord is ripped. I did one of those tandem skydives. And it is incredibly painful around the groin. It really pitches up. But it is a very reassuring pain. Because otherwise, you're going to hurtle. I wouldn't recommend it. Something to do when you're 20, when you're fearless. Another tweet from AFC Filed. The saga comes to a conclusion as he topples the fence and falls on his face, but only after showing a clean set of heels to the stewards, a turn of pace I didn't think he had, to be honest. Right, that'll do for today's pod. Barry, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Racing Post's Mark Langdon.
Thank you, Max.
And thank you, Jonathan Wilson.
Thank you. I'll see you next month.
Yeah, have a lovely holiday. We shall be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
No, I don't know what the stats are now. Before the weekend, no side was outperforming their VAR more than Liverpool were.
Outperforming their VAR?
Their VAR, their XG.
Okay.
What is true, though, is that before this weekend, no side was outperforming... Sorry. What is true, though, is that before this weekend...
What's true, John?
What is true, though...
Oh, I'm looking really enjoying this. I hope this is a secret bit at the end of the pod.
This better be good.
Yeah.
What is true, though, is that before... Oh, it's not important. What is true, though, is that before this weekend... What is true, though, is before this weekend...
Would you like us all to leave the room so you can say...
I'll close my eyes. What is true, though...
Start it again.
What is true, though, is before this weekend... What is true, though...
You've got to give yourself a bit more time.
What is true, though, is that no side... What is true, though...